U.S. police attacked students holding anti-Israel campus rallies, protested the regime's genocide in Gaza, arresting hundreds of protesters.
Well, welcome to the studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Mias. Thanks for joining us.
Palestinian officials say that mass graves discovered in the vicinity of hospitals, which were destroyed by Israeli forces in the Gaza Strip, show evidence of field executions. According to Palestinian civil defense officials, bodies found in three separate mass graves around Nasser Hospital were stacked together. They said that a number of the bodies had their hands bound, while some others still had medical tubes attached to them, indicating that they may have been buried alive. The Palestinian civil defense added some of the bodies belonged to children. Out of nearly 400 bodies recovered in Gaza's mass graves, only 65 have been identified by their relatives. The majority of the bodies remain unidentifiable because of advanced decomposition or mutilation, pointing to evidence that some may have been tortured before being killed or buried alive by the Israeli forces. More than 200 days into Israel's genocide in Gaza, Palestinians continue to fall victim to the regime's indiscriminate airstrikes and artillery fire across the besieged strip. Palestinian journalist Mohammed Bassam al-Jamal has been killed along with his family members in an attack on their house in the city of Rafah. His death brings to 139 the number of journalists killed in the Gaza war. A separate attack targeting a highway in central Gaza left at least 8 Palestinians dead. Dozens of people are also killed and injured in strikes on several other locations, including the Al-Zaytun neighborhood in the southeast, the Shati refugee camp, and the Nasser neighborhood in the west and Khan Yunis in the south of Gaza. The death toll from the Israeli war in Gaza has now surpassed 34,300, including 14,000 children. Over 77,000 people have also been injured, while thousands more remain unaccounted for. Israel's indiscriminate bombings of Gaza continue to cause death and massive destruction in the besieged territory. A recent airstrike on a residential building has killed more Palestinians in Rafah, where millions are seeking refuge. Let's take a listen to what the relatives of some of the victims had to say.
We were all in the house, my brother and I in a bedroom. My mother and my grandfather were awake when they shelled the house at night. The rubble was above our head. Look, the whole house was destroyed. Nothing is left in it. Are they happy now? We have nothing left.
The house was targeted with 2 missiles. Without warning, several displaced people were seeking refuge there. A number of people who were in the house were members of my family, my brother Mohammed and my niece Shamun Najjar, along with relatives from Nabhan family were all martyred in this strike. They were originally displaced from Khan Yunis and sought refuge here. Before that, they hit a house next to us and my nephew was martyred. This is the second strike in which 6 martyrs were lost.
When I tell you about them, they were first displaced to Khan Yunis, then to Rafah. My uncle is a university professor. His son Ahmed is a doctor in the agency's clinics, and Abdullah is an engineer in private institutions. I mean, the three of them have no political affiliation, nothing. But God is sufficient for us, and He is the best disposer of our affairs in this war.
There's no end in sight to Israeli raids on the occupied West Bank. The regime's forces have carried out an incursion into the city of Ramallah. A 16-year-old boy was killed after they fired live rounds on a group of Palestinians. The regime has intensified its raids and attacks across the occupied territories since launching a genocidal war on Gaza in October. Earlier, we were joined by our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, for more details.
It's obvious now that every time the Israeli forces storm Palestinian areas, villages, towns, cities, the Israeli soldiers use their guns, even if there are no threats against them from the Palestinians. This time, Israeli soldiers raided the city of Ramallah, stormed Al-Tiri area, stormed the old town of Ramallah, as well as the Umm Sharayat neighborhood, in order to arrest Palestinians. This is what the Israeli military continue to justify the raiding of Palestinian areas. During the military to Ramallah, Israeli soldiers opened fire at Palestinians who went to the streets in order to prevent any Israeli aggression against the people. During the military raid, forces opened fire, shot and killed 16-year-old Khaled Arqawi. Khaled Arqawi from Jenin city, and the Palestinians in Jenin city and refugee camp mourned Khaled Arqawi, and they were expecting his body to be transferred from Ramallah to Jenin in order to be buried there.
Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah and Israeli forces have once again exchanged fire as the southern Lebanese border remains tense over the war in Gaza. In the latest raids, Israeli warplanes targeted a number of Lebanese villages and towns. Let's speak to our correspondent of Beirut, Mariam Saleh, who joins us for more details. Mariam, over to you.
Well, we know the Israelis have caused mass fires, actually, really great fires in the outskirts of the villages of Yarun and Al-Mashab as well. And once we know that the fires, the fire trucks attempted to go and extinguish that fire, then they were also met with more Israeli bombs. And the fire continues now, especially in the forest or the woods of Yarun. And that is considered one of the main resources for Lebanon, of its natural wildlife. Of course, that is destructive to Lebanon, not only on the civilian population, but also when it comes to its green spaces as well. The Israelis have also launched heavy shelling and phosphorus bombs on several areas, on Al-Mashab, on Naqoura as well, and on the Mount Blot area, which is also another place which is a natural reserve recognized by the government. We also had several artillery fire against Kfar Shuba and Rub al-Tlatin, and of course that is only some of the towns that continue to be bombarded by the Israelis. Now Hezbollah has today launched two operations, one against specifically soldiers in the vicinity of the Dhaira post. They also launched another operation in the Zibdin area, in the occupied Shaba farms, and these are just two, of course, operations which we could see. There could be more operations continuing throughout the day. We saw that Hezbollah had definitely escalated their operations in the last week or so, and it all also depends on the Israeli conduct. We've seen how Hezbollah is quite consistent when it comes to how they deal with the Israeli attacks, and despite the fact that their operations did begin in support of the resistance in Palestine, Palestinian people. But we see now that their operations are mainly retaliatory, especially since the Israelis are targeting areas where there are civilians, and they have killed several civilians among the population in South Lebanon, in addition to the fact that they have targeted several areas in eastern Lebanon, in Baalbek and the Bekaa area as well. Now, we also know from Israeli reports that the entire area, the Galilee region, it's paralyzed. We know from their reports, there are several reports, one that talks about the economic situation and the fact that the Galilee region is not only paralyzed because of this military issue. We know that that area was a livelihood for the Israeli regime's economy, and especially now with the Hebrew Passover, that usually no one can find one single room in the hotels, and it would be packed and crowded with tourists. So the tourist sector has also been paralyzed as a result of Hezbollah's operations. This has been detrimental to the Israeli economy. We know that businesses are falling apart as well, and there is absolutely no horizon or promises from the government of compensation. We also, there's other reports from Israeli analysts and experts and former generals talking about the operation in the Akka region and how Hezbollah was extremely precise and how they are consistent when it comes to the geographic distance, because the Israelis were going further when it comes to within the geography or even deep in the heart of Lebanon, and therefore Hezbollah was going further in their attacks, and they knew and had the intelligence of the Golani and Egos whereabouts and their headquarters, in addition to the fact that they had the capabilities to be able to not be detected, and their missiles or their drones not to be detected by the defense systems of the Israelis. Now, this also comes at a time when we are seeing that there is an upping of pressure on the political level through channels from the Americans. They are pushing, it seems, the French, the Arabs, the Egyptians, all the ambassadors, basically, that are allies to the U.S. and Lebanon are putting a lot of pressure on the government. They are trying to make the Lebanese government put pressure also on Hezbollah to separate between Lebanon itself and the Gaza and what's happening inside Palestine. Hezbollah has refused. They say they will continue with their supportive stance, but at the same time, what happens within the political spectrum in Lebanon is something that can continue. Hezbollah has made it clear that we can have an election of a president, but they will not stop their operations. It seems we know from the U.S. officials, they're stressing that they're putting all their efforts now to put pressure on the Lebanese government to try to basically get some concessions and to stop Hezbollah's operations. These, of course, have not been successful so far.
All right. Thank you so much for that. We appreciate it. Mariam Saleh from Beirut. Thank you. Moving on, Yemen's Ansarullah leader says the country's anti-Israel operations will continue expanding in the Red Sea as well as the Indian Ocean. Addressing Yemeni people in a televised speech, Abdul Malik al-Houthi said the U.S. and its allies were surprised to see Yemeni operations in the Indian Ocean. He said now the U.S. and U.K. military ships are to avoid certain locations in the Red Sea due to Yemeni operations. Houthi also pointed to the U.S. admission of Sana'a's military might and the West's failure to protect their ships. The Ansarullah leader also rejected the U.S. claims that the Yemeni operations have decreased and noted that there has only been a reduction in the number of ships sailing to the Red Sea. Al-Houthi said that since the beginning of the U.S.-Israeli genocide in Gaza, the Yemeni army has targeted 102 vessels in support of the Palestinian people. Yemenis say that their operations have successfully impacted the economies of Israel and its allies by increasing their shipping costs. Germany has withdrawn a warship from the Red Sea following the failure of an EU military mission to confront Yemen's maritime campaign in support of the Gaza Strip. The frigate had been deployed in the strategic waterway in February, in the face of pro-Palestine operations by the Yemeni armed forces. Abdul Latif al-Washali reports from Sana'a.
Following the failure of the so-called International Naval Coalition to halt the Yemeni army's pro-Palestinian assault against Israeli-affiliated vessels, the German frigate FGS Hessen has left the Red Sea after 58 days, concluding its mission alongside an American and British coalition. This coalition aimed to safeguard Israeli navigation amidst Yemeni forces imposing a stifling blockade on Israeli maritime traffic.
A bigger war was looming large after the appearance of Western fleets in the Red Sea. The vision has now become clear after the operations of the Yemeni army and Ansarullah against Israeli ships. Certainly, there is another tactic, vision, and attempts to find solutions after the Western failure to stop the Yemeni attacks. The withdrawal is not a radical withdrawal and may be a strategic change in Western plans in the Red Sea.
While some military experts speculate that this German departure may indicate repositioning and preparation for a major regional war, the Deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs welcomed the withdrawal, underscoring Sana'a's primary concern for the safety of international maritime navigation. He urged the world to treat Yemen with respect to safeguard their interests.
The departure of the German frigate from the Yemeni coast is the beginning of the departure of many ships, despite American pressure on countries to join the U.S. operations in the Red Sea. In fact, the Yemeni army possesses weapons carrying new surprises that will force all Western ships to leave. We are prepared for any scenario that the West is planning, whether returning to a broader war or otherwise. Our siege on Israel will continue and will not stop unless the aggressive war on Gaza stops.
Germany's FGS Hessen becomes the fourth warship to depart from the Red Sea since the inception of the European Union's naval mission Aspides, which alongside the US-led coalition has failed to protect Israeli-affiliated vessels from Yemeni attacks supporting Palestinian resistance.
With Yemen's armed forces having successfully attacked over 100 vessels linked to Israel, observers speculate that recent Western actions may indicate preparation for a new phase of confrontation with Yemeni forces. However, Sana'a has reiterated that Yemen's pro-Palestinian naval operations will persist until the Israeli war on Gaza comes to an end. Abdul Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
U.S. police have arrested nearly 100 pro-Palestinian protesters at the University of Southern California as campus demonstrations continue to spread across the country. American students from California to Massachusetts hold sit-ins in support of Palestinians in Gaza. The protesters called for a ceasefire in the Gaza Strip and an end to the U.S. support for the Israeli regime. Some of them chanted slogans such as "Jews want the end of the war." On many campuses, the students have set up tents to press their demands. They are also calling on U.S. universities to divest from companies with ties to Israel. Hundreds of students and others have been arrested at Columbia, Yale, and New York universities since Friday. Pro-Palestine protests have been held in numerous other universities in Columbia, Texas, Ohio, California, New York, and Michigan. Well, up next, we're going to elaborate on Iran's punitive strikes, dubbed Operation True Promise, against the Israeli regime's positions in the occupied territories, which resulted in a relative change in power equation and rules of engagement in West Asia.
It happened on April 1st, the madness that resulted in a change to equation of power in West Asia.
We are tracking breaking news out of the Middle East, an attack on Iran's consulate building in Syria.
As crazy as it sounds, but apparently not crazy enough for the Israeli regime that violated the sanctity of Iranian diplomatic premises by carrying out the attack. The strike left 7 Iranian military advisors martyred, including 2 senior commanders of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. It was condemned by heads of state, politicians, and resistance groups as a violation of the UN Charter and Vienna Conventions. Nevertheless, the United Nations Security Council failed to adopt measures in order to punish Israel for this crime. Following the UNSC's inaction and passivity, Iran had to take the matter into its own hands and punish Israel as asserted by Iran's leader. The promise of retaliation kept Israel on edge for almost 2 weeks before being fulfilled on April 13. Operation True Promise was the codename. Iran fired a barrage of more than 300 missiles and drones from its soil at targets within the 1948 occupied territory. The retaliation by Iran was described as the biggest drone attack in history. It was widely welcomed and applauded, with people taking to the streets in celebration. Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank also posted online videos of their celebrations and images of the extraordinary projectiles fired towards the occupying regime.
Ya Allah! Ya Allah! Allah! Allahu Akbar! Ya Hussein! Allahu Akbar! Allahu Akbar! Ya Allah! Allahu Akbar!
Allah! Nizal! Nizal!
Nizal! Nizal! Nizal! Darabuha!
Allahu Akbar!
Wislu!
More than 10 allied countries rushed to help Israel with their full defense capacity in the region. This, of course, included the U.S., that brought in 3 of its unified combatant commands, European Command, Central Command, and the Space Command, with the Ramstein Air Base in Germany operating as the command center. The U.S. also deployed a missile interceptor system never used before, the SM-3 Ballistic Missile Interceptor. 2 American warships in the Mediterranean Sea used it for the first time to intercept Iranian missiles. Yet all these efforts did not seem to bear the expected fruit. Israel's most important military base, the Nevatim Air Base, and Mount Hermon military intelligence site were successfully hit. That means the entire defense capabilities of Israel and those of its allies failed to protect the targets in the occupied lands from Iranian missiles, even though Iran did not employ the full capacity of its drones and missiles. The damage was done, but that was seemingly too much for Israel and its allies to admit.
The Israeli government says it shot down 99% of drones and missiles.
The new assignment for the Israeli allied media was creating a fake image of victory for Israel by downplaying the impact of Iran's missiles, something considered by Tehran as a secondary issue. The rules of engagement were changed, and the equation of power in West Asia shifted in favor of Iran and the axis of resistance.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
Hidden files. Well, it is hard to believe that we are still witnessing this Zionist Holocaust take place against the Palestinians in Gaza. How is it possible that 4% of the population in Gaza has been killed or injured? How is it possible that this is still going on? What happened to the leaders of the world? What happened to international law? These are questions that many people have been asking since the start of this genocide. Well, I'm Marzia Hashimi, and this is Hidden Files. And today we'll be talking to someone who has spent most of his life working in the field of international law and working for various international human rights organizations. Perhaps he can shed some light on the reasons we are still watching genocide in real time without it being forced to be stopped. But before we talk to our guests, let's take a look at this example of an Orwellian realm of doublethink that we recently saw from U.S. President Joe Biden, which is the root of the problem we're facing in countering this genocide.
What is your red line with Prime Minister Netanyahu? Do you have a red line? For instance, would invasion of Rafah, which you have urged him not to do, would that be a red line?
It is a red line, but I'm never going to leave Israel. The defense of Israel is still critical. So there's no red line. I'm going to cut off all weapons so they don't have the Iron Dome to protect them. They don't have. But there's red lines that if it crosses, and they cannot have 30,000 more Palestinians dead as a consequence of going after. There's other ways to deal, to get to deal with the trauma caused by Hamas. And it's like the first time I went over, I sat with them and I sat with a war cabinet. I said, look, don't make the mistake.
Well, as mind-boggling as that is, it is the reality coming out of Washington when dealing with the Israeli regime. Well, I'd like to bring in our guest now who may be able to explain to us how we got here and why has international law failed the people of Palestine.
Alfred Morris de Zayas is an American lawyer, writer, historian, and expert in the field of human rights and international law, a retired high-ranking United Nations official, a peace activist, and since 2012, the United Nations independent expert on the promotion of democratic and equitable international order, also known as Special Rapporteur, appointed by the United Nations Human Rights Council. He is a retired senior lawyer with the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights and former Secretary of the Human Rights Committee and Chief of the Petition Section.
Welcome to Hidden Files, Alfred Maurice de Zayas. With your experience, perhaps you can explain to us what is happening and why we're seeing this total breakdown in international law. I mean, from a strictly legal sense, which international laws would you say have been violated in Gaza since October, and how would you define these crimes?
Well, the International Court of Justice already, back in 2004, had the opportunity to examine the practice and the legislation in Israel vis-a-vis the Palestinians. And they determined that there were serious violations of the international human rights regime. That entails the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, the Convention on the Rights of the Child, the Convention Against Torture, the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination. Then they also went into international humanitarian law and actions that Israel has done, collective punishment, destruction of private property in occupied territory, etc., which all violates the Hague Conventions of 1907 and, of course, the Geneva Conventions of 1949 and the 1977 protocols. Now, at that time, when we talk about the Gaza war, one of the problems that I detect in the media, primarily the narrative of the mainstream media, is that they focus on the 7th of October, 2023, as if the war had started in 2023, whereas obviously the conflict goes back to the mandate that the Brits had over Palestine. And the Nakba, the catastrophe that fell upon the Palestinians when the Israelis waged war on them in 1947-48, expelled a million of them, devastated their houses and their olive orchards, etc., etc. And ever since 1947-48, it's been an ongoing war against the Palestinians and always occupation, occupation of Palestinian territory, denial of the right of the Palestinians of self-determination.
Well, based on what you said and the various sightings that you've just discussed, Israel is an occupation force and the Palestinians have the right to defend themselves and fight the occupiers. But the reality seems to be something else.
Well, that is the problem with international law, because international law is not self-executing. The International Court of Justice cannot enforce its judgment. It depends on the good faith and the goodwill of the state parties to the statute of the ICJ. And of course, the rulings of the Security Council, say, take Resolution 242 of 1967, that was after the Six-Day War. Israel is ordered by the Security Council to withdraw its army. Never did. So this is something that goes back nearly 60 years of daily violation of Security Council Resolution 242. When a Security Council resolution is violated, then what usually would happen is that you would have a follow-up resolution imposing sanctions under Article 41. But that's impossible because the United States blocks it. Now, one of the most atrocious abuses of the veto power by the United States. We have just seen it over the last weeks. The United States has blocked not one, but three Security Council resolutions demanding a ceasefire in Gaza. What does that tell you? Considering that a case is pending before the International Court of Justice, considering that on the 26th of January, the International Court of Justice decided not only that it had jurisdiction, but that there was a plausible case of genocide in progress, thereby justifying the issuance of an order, what is called provisional measures. So the International Court of Justice adopts a rather comprehensive list of orders to Israel, which Israel has violated, has completely ignored. So that adds insult to injury.
Well, you've researched about the rights of minorities throughout the world. I mean, is there anything comparable to the Palestinian case in your perspective?
Well, you have to go a bit further back in history. We Europeans and Americans have a legacy of colonialism and imperialism. And when the Brits came to North America, there used to be 10 million indigenous in North America. And by the end of the 19th century, there were only 200,000 left. So more than 90% of the indigenous were wiped out. People try to excuse it and say, oh, well, they all got sick because of European diseases. No doubt, smallpox and other European diseases probably killed as many as 50% of the indigenous population. But the rest of the 50% were wiped out deliberately by the U.S. forces that kept pushing them further and further west, slaughtered their buffalo, burnt their crops, burnt their villages, slaughtered the civilians. You have so many. Wounded Knee is one of many, many massacres. And people have written quite a bit about the Wounded Knee. As the case may be, that is an example of the deliberate genocide committed by the American governments, a whole series of American governments, under the banner of manifest destiny. So our destiny was to conquer the entire territory, except that according to the doctrine of discovery, you can only discover territory that is terra nullius, territory that doesn't belong to anybody. But when you come to a territory where 10 million people are already settled and they have cities and villages and irrigation and all sorts of things, and what do? You wipe them out because you want the territory, but you don't want the people. You're so racist that you don't want to incorporate the indigenous population into your society. So, first of all, you push them out, you expel them, and you make treaties with them, they trust you, and then you break all the treaties, one right after the other. So, on occasion, the indigenous decided they're gonna fight back. And since they were so comparatively weak militarily, they were then crushed by the military power of the United States. Now, Martin Luther King Jr., everybody knows him, respects him, etc. Everybody pays tribute to him. But how about reading what he actually said in his book, Why We Can't Wait, published in 1964, page 141. Martin Luther King writes, "Our country was born in genocide." And then he goes on, not to talk about slavery, not to talk about segregation and what the Afro-Americans had to endure. He talks about the extermination of the Algonquins and the Crees and the Cherokees and the Navajos and the Dakotas and Lakotas and Sioux and Hopi, etc., etc. And he complains that because of the, shall we say, narrative that we get in history books, this conquest of the Golden West is a success story. Of course, for the whites. I mean, we stole the entire continent and we massacred the population. And he says, as an Afro-American, this is a disgrace. What kind of morals do we have? Are we at all a Christian country? Do we have a moral compass?
Well, thanks so much. Stay with me, Alfred. We'll be right back right after this. Well, thanks so much for staying with me, Alfred. Continuing our discussion, you know, in your previous books, you've explained that genocides generally occur with the knowledge of a small number of people. Do you see an analogy with Palestine today, given the comparative silence of Western politicians and media bias?
Well, take the Holocaust. The Nazis bent over backwards to hide what they were doing. I mean, they did not have Auschwitz and Majdanek and Sobibor in Frankfurt or in Hamburg or in Berlin. They had it out in Poland and in Ukraine so that the population would not find out about it. And there were rumors, and as soon as there were rumors, they were denied. And those who were spreading the rumors landed themselves in concentration camps. Because people seem to forget that Dachau was opened not for Jews. Dachau was opened to imprison first the communists, then the socialists, anybody who did not bend to the will of Hitler, and there were plenty of Germans who were not bending to his will. They landed in Buchenwald, they landed in Bergen-Belsen, etc., which were not per se extermination camps. The six extermination camps were all in the east. I mean, Treblinka and Lublin, Majdanek, etc., etc. So that the Germans knew that what they were doing was criminal. What's amazing in comparison to what's going on in Gaza is that it's so public. You can watch it on television. You can click on your internet and you have all of these horrendous pictures of hospitals and schools and UN shelters. We have lost a couple of hundred of UN staffers, victims of the indiscriminate bombardment by Israel. And then there is a mainstream narrative that tells you that the Israeli Defense Forces, the IDF, is very careful not to hurt civilians, that they only target military objectives. And if they kill civilians, this is collateral damage. It's not intended.
Right, but the Israeli regime itself, I mean, has no qualms about publicly commenting about their genocide, whether it's saying that we're going to wipe them out or Amalek. You talked about the Nazis and trying to hide what they had done. But the Israelis don't try to hide it. Your thoughts about this?
That has a psychological explanation. We Americans, we are educated from very small in grammar school, in primary, in secondary school, that we are, by definition, the good guys, which of course means that everybody else is the bad guy. So we are educated to believe that we are special, that we are exceptional, that we are the indispensable people. And then you have the phenomenon that you're so convinced, you're such a solipsist, me and me and me, that you fear whatever rival there is. So instead of educating the American people or the Israeli people, or for that matter the French or the Germans, etc., that we're the same as everybody else, that we're all children of God, and that we all share this one little planet of ours, and that we have to live together, instead of teaching that, we are taught to fear. There is a culture of fear inculcated in every student, in every pupil, whether it be the United States, United Kingdom, France, Germany, Israel. I mean, we are by definition the good ones, and the others are threatening us. So you play with the emotions of the population, and remarkably enough, the masses believe it. That is our problem. The capacity of self-deception of the population is very, very great, and the faculty of self-criticism is totally underdeveloped. You have, of course, brilliant professors, John Mearsheimer, Jeffrey Sachs, Francis Boyle, Richard Falk, Stephen Kinzer, Dan Kovalik, who see very clearly what's going on, and they write very clearly about it. But do they come in the New York Times, in the Washington Post, in CNN? Hardly. The New York Times and Washington Post, for instance, never wants to hear my point of view, and when I send them op-ed articles, they never publish them, because I'm not singing the song that they want to hear. Right. So I don't exist. And some of these great scholars, even including Noam Chomsky, are shoved aside because their analysis doesn't fit the agendas of our military, industrial, financial, digital complex. So everything actually revolves around money. The military industrial complex needs war if it wants to make money. We need to sell arms, and only sell arms if the arms are destroyed in war. You can't sell a new tank if they have an army with several tank battalions, and the tanks are still intact, so you can't sell them anymore. So you have to make sure that there's a war so that these tanks, so the Leopard tanks and the Abrams tanks, are destroyed, so you sell a couple more. Same thing with planes, same thing with missiles, same thing with drones. So the whole thing is a financial scam. It's a way of a perpetuum mobile, of constantly feeding wars. How do we do that? Through propaganda. We do that through instilling in the population this fear that justifies ever higher military budgets.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. In the limelight.
Eyewitnesses said that during the Zionist regime's invasion of the Nuseirat camp, invading Israeli forces targeted everyone and everything that moved in the northern part of the camp. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, during the last few days, Nuseirat in the central Gaza Strip has been the target of relentless Israeli regime bombardment and artillery shelling. Israeli occupation forces invaded the camp under intense fire, and they only withdrew after several days due to the stiff resistance they met. Before the invasion of the camp, many Palestinians who had been displaced in the southern area of the Strip for months had decided to return to their homes in central Gaza. The decision was made on the basis of many considerations. First, there is no safe place in the war-torn Strip. As repeatedly stated by many institutions and organizations throughout the 6 months of the Zionist regime's genocidal war on Gaza. Second, life conditions in the makeshift refugee camps in Rafah are unbearable due to the spread of disease and the lack of space. Third, Israeli occupation forces often threaten to invade the southernmost city of Rafah, which is now overpopulated by hundreds of thousands of displaced Palestinians looking for safety. Many people who decided to return to Nuseirat, however, were met by a tragic fate. It was the case of Mazen Matar Abu Muhammad, who was displaced to Rafah City with his family for months and decided to go back to his house just a few days before the Israeli invasion of the camp. Amr al-Saidawi told the Palestine Chronicle, I met our neighbor, Abu Muhammad, on Sunday afternoon. I hadn't seen him in several months because he and his family had been displaced to the south. I missed him a lot, so I warmly greeted him. He told me that he was going to check on his home, located in Al-Mufti area, north of Nuseirat. I was worried about the shelling and I asked him not to go. But Abu Muhammad insisted because he wanted to assess the condition of the building. After half an hour, however, the Zionist regime shelling intensified in Al-Mufti area and Al-Saidawi learned that his beloved neighbor had been murdered. Al-Saidawi said, Abu Muhammad entered his house and walked around. inspecting the damage caused by the continuous shelling on the camp since the beginning of the war. He continued, "He stayed in the house for only a few minutes. Then he hurriedly left due to the intensification of the Israeli shelling." Al-Saidawi explained, "Abu Muhammad rushed out of his house to return to his family, who were still living in a tent in Rafah City. He closed the door of his house, but he could barely walk a few steps. Abu Muhammad's children were waiting for their father to return with some summer clothes, as they were still wearing winter clothes when they were displaced to Rafah, but he returned to them as a martyr. And they will have to face the war without his support," Al-Saidawi explained in tears. Eyewitnesses said that during the invasion of the camp, invading Israeli regime forces targeted everyone and everything that moved in northern Nuseirat. Ahad Matar told the Palestine Chronicle, "Our neighbor Muhammad Shahada was targeted by an Israeli quadcopter as he stood at the door of his house, and he died from his wounds 2 days later." Matar continued, "The son of another neighbor from Al-Wawi family was also injured while sitting in his room. The quadcopter fired a bullet at his neck, and he's still receiving treatment at the hospital." Anas al-Hawajiri told the Palestine Chronicle, "The latest operation was the toughest for the residents of the Nuseirat refugee camp. The latest military operation was carried out in a surprise move by the Zionist regime army, and the residents of the northern areas of the camp were not able to leave their homes due to the relentless shelling." Al-Hawajiri said, "The occupation targeted the house of our neighbors from Abu Atiyeh family, killing and wounding its members," adding that hundreds of buildings and residential units in the camp were destroyed. Al-Hawajiri continued, "The occupation killed everything and everyone that moved in the northern areas of Nuseirat. It targeted civilians with airplanes, artillery shells, and a hail of bullets using vehicles and quadcopters." He said, "We managed to leave our home, but when we returned, we found our home turned into rubble. We lost our home, our shelter, our refuge."
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.